You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, December 24th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live. Live to tape. Steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, it is that time of year again where we bring out mistletoe and sometimes cold weather gear, not necessarily this year, but certainly in years past, and we drink a tremendous amount of eggnog and other alcohol because maybe we're at our in-laws. We're not even in studio. We've pre-recorded this, and we're at our in-laws trying to maintain a level of inebriation to be able to not cause any type of incident. So it's just I take the kids, I put them out in front, and then I have the candied food. All the food is candied. At the holidays, the salad dipped in some type of sugar-coated candy. The vegetables, of course, candied vegetables. The protein, whatever it is, the chicken, the ham, candied. And candied rice, candied couscous. There's no couscous. Who am I kidding? I'm in the middle of the country. And so I am now just stuffing my face with cookies and probably as you listen to this and slightly drunk. But that doesn't mean that you don't have some of the 2015 best of episodes to listen to. Ladies and gentlemen, we are starting off this year on the best ofs with the great Professor Walter Block. Yes, Walter Block. He's at the business school of Tulane University, I believe it is.
Loyola
University, the business school there.
Artist de victim.
I don't even know what that means. He
it's Walter Block
is known as one of Ron Paul's advisors. He is a secret advisor to Rand Paul, as he claimed at one point. And this is the second appearance of his on the program. Far less contentious than the first one. But equally as fascinating, where he tells us the theory of how we would all deal with a libertarian system of justice. You're going to want to listen to this. It's rather enjoyable. And then, as sort of like a, I don't want to say antidote, but as a twist, we're adding on another entire interview. There's so much. You're going to be able to listen to this on the plane rides, the car rides, as you head home for the holidays or head away from your home for the holidays or just head into the abyss for the holidays, ladies and gentlemen. Mark Ames of, what's the name of the place again, sir?
Pando Daily.
Michael interviewed Mark Ames of Pando Daily. And Mark Ames is, I would describe him as specifically anti-libertarian in many respects. In much of the stuff that he writes. He really does not like libertarians. And in this instance, Michael talks to him about corporations being a bigger threat to the freedom of press than government, and also on, what else? What was the
Well, I liked it because I'm a Seymour Hersh fan. I remember this because this was before my time here. But it stuck with me because of why Hersh didn't focus on private power, instead focusing on public power and like public individuals. So it's pretty interesting in that regard.
There you go. And so there's Matt. And Matt has largely overseen this best of process. So if you have any complaints, you know where to send the emails to just put in the subject line, Matt, how could you? At majorityreporters@gmail.com. All right, folks, enjoy today's best of. We will not have a show tomorrow, but then starting on Monday, we will have five other best ofs. All right, got to take, we'll take a little musical interlude, and then you will hear these two interviews, and we'll see you on Monday. Have a great Christmas if that's what you celebrate. And if you don't celebrate it, then I hope you are as inebriated as I am as you watch others celebrate it around you. See you on Monday.
I was following the eye, 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 was following the pack, all swallowed in their coats, the scarves of red tied round their throats to keep their little heads from falling in the snow.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program Dr. Walter Block. He is a economist at the business school at Loyola University, a longtime libertarian as well. Professor, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Just to catch up new listeners to this program, we had a debate, I guess now it was back in May of last year. And, I want to just clear the air of one thing, and that was that I think at the time you felt that I didn't quite give you as much time as I wasn't quite fair with doling out the time, I guess, in the context of our debate / interview conversation. And I just wanted to say that one of our listeners, whose handle is Fred at Khan College, who I think we actually may get as an intern, did a breakdown of our of a comparative analysis of talking times during our debate from that day. And we've linked to it on the site. But I think you'll find that you did okay, and I hope to provide a similar breakdown this time.
I really have no problem. If I thought I was being treated vastly unfairly, I wouldn't be back on your program. So I guess my own comfort level is, you know, more formal. You know, you get 5 minutes, I get 5 minutes, you get 3 minutes, I get 3 minutes. But I'm happy to have a conversation with you. And in retrospect, I don't think I was really dealt with unfairly. And as I say, if I really thought that, I wouldn't be here now. So no problem.
Great. I'm glad that was your feeling. Now, I want to start off with a question that has actually been posed by a listener of this program who calls in quite a bit, and he is a bit of a self-identified libertarian. And he had a question for you, which I thought was a good way to start off, just so that, because one of the challenges I've had with taking phone calls from libertarians is that every maybe every is an exaggeration, but nearly all libertarians who call into this program say that the other libertarians who have called into this program are not really libertarians. And so the question that he poses is, what's the difference between consequentialist and deontological libertarianism, and which one are you?
Right. You know, the joke among libertarian circles is if you get 10 libertarians in a room on any given issue, you'll have 11 different opinions. Another one is organized libertarians, sort of like herding cats. It can't be done. I'm a professor. I'm never supposed to answer questions exactly or on point. So let me deviate a little bit from your question, although I will answer it. There are four kinds of libertarians, in my view. And deontological versus utilitarian or consequentialist is sort of a different dimension of distinction between libertarians. The main differences, as I see it, between libertarians is there are four. The first one is anarcho-capitalist, of which I'm one. And we say that the essence of libertarianism is the non-aggression principle. Keep your mitts to yourself. Don't invade or aggress against anyone else. And since the government necessarily does it, we're all anarchists. The second group, and I guess the most famous people there would be Murray Rothbard. The second group would be minarchists, minimal government libertarians, and the most famous people there would be Ayn Rand and Robert Nozick, and they also adhere to the non-aggression principle, as do all libertarians, but I don't think they're as logically consistent. And what they say is that we should have minimal government, and the government should just have armies to keep foreign bad guys off of us, police to keep local bad guys off of us, and courts to determine who the good guys and the bad guys are. The third group, and I'm in descending order in terms of purity in my view, the third one would be constitutionalist libertarians like Ron Paul, who believe in the U.S. Constitution, and I would even include Rand Paul in this too, and pretty much anything the Constitution says is what libertarianism is all about. And the fourth group I would call classical liberals, Milton Friedman and Friedrich Hayek. And those people certainly agree with minimal government, night watchman libertarianism, but they would add more. Welfare programs, vouchers, other things like that. So that would be the four breakdowns. So if you heard from any one of those four, the other three would say, well, he's not really a libertarian. Whereas in my view, they're all libertarians. Libertarianism is a many splendored thing. There are many mansions, and I'm a big tent kind of a guy. Now, to answer your question finally, the difference between consequentialist and deontological libertarianism is a consequentialist is sort of like utilitarian. What the consequentialist or utilitarian libertarians say is, if you follow the non-aggression principle, that's the route to human happiness. We'll all be happier if people keep their mitts to themselves and government is either non-existent or very limited. Whereas the deontological libertarians are much more logical. It's not that the other people are illogical, but it's based on logic. Namely, we deduce from the non-aggression principle plus homesteading for private property rights, and wherever that leads us, even, justice though the heavens fall, we don't care about utility. We only care about rights. So the deontological libertarian would talk about rights, and the utilitarian or consequentialist libertarian would talk about human happiness also as emanating from the non-aggression principle.
And you are a consequentialist, is that it?
No, I'm a deontological libertarian, and I'm also an anarcho-capitalist. So there are two different dimensions, so to speak, and those are my two positions.
So let me ask you about this. I mean, just in terms of the non-aggression principle, how in the world that you imagine, how does one maintain property rights?
Well, in my view as a anarcho-capitalist, there would be private defense agencies that had police forces or armies. And if you stole my wallet, for example, let's say, and my wallet is legitimately mine, I would call the police. I would call the private police agency, and they would come get you and, you know, make you disgorge the wallet and punish you according to libertarian punishment theory. If I were a minarchist, I would just call the government and I'd say, hey, Sam stole my wallet. Go get him. And if Sam said, no, I didn't really steal it, then we would have to adjudicate it through the court.
Now, so in... Well, okay, that raises a couple of questions for me. I mean, the first being that, I mean, who gets to determine if you're not a minarchist
A
minarchist. If you're not a minarchist, who gets to determine whether or not I really stole your wallet?
Well, we would have a series of competing courts. And let's suppose you deny that you stole the wallet. You claim that I stole it from you yesterday and you're just repossessing it or something like that. Well, you would go to your court, call it Court A, mm-hmm. and you would invite me to go to Court A, and I'd say, what, Court A, that's your brother or your mother. I'm not going to Court A. And I would go to Court F as in Frank, and I would invite you to come to my court, and you'd say, what, Court F, that's your mother, your brother, your friend, whatever, I'm not going. And and then we would each go to our own courts. And now it's possible that both, and when you go to a court, you sign an agreement that you'll obey or abide by what the court says. Now it's possible that both courts will agree with you, in which case it's sort of case closed. You know, both courts and police will, you know, come after me because they both agreed with you, or vice versa. It's possible that both courts will agree with me, in which case, you know, you'd better give me that wallet back because not only my court, but your court dash police will come after you. Okay, so the more interesting case is suppose the courts disagree. Now, one possibility, which we won't consider, is that my court agrees with you and your court agrees with me. Let's forget about that for the moment. And let's assume that your court agrees with you and my court agrees with me. Now, Ayn Rand, who is a minarchist, says at this point, blank out, you know, you anarchist libertarians. By the way, the debates among libertarians are pretty ferocious. She says, blank out. Then what happens? You know, the courts fight. And the answer to that, coming from my quarter of libertarianism, is no. There are two types of courts. One type of court, we call them legitimate courts, are courts that will anticipate Court A and Court F will recognize each other as courts and will say, look, you know, if ever we come up with a dispute and we come up on the opposite side of this dispute, let's go to Court C, as in trolley, or take a random number. You know, we'll have 15 courts that we all agree are legitimate courts, and we'll pick one of them, and their decision will be final, and that'll settle it. On the other hand, there might be bandit courts. Bandit courts are either too stupid to realize that they might be on opposite sides of an issue, or they say, I don't care, you know, my way or the highway. And the point is that the bandit courts would have to fight everyone. They would have to fight other bandit courts and legitimate courts, whereas the legitimate courts would only have to fight bandit courts. And the point is that fighting is expensive. They'd have to pay more for their soldiers or their policemen. And presumably they would, go the way of the dodo bird. We wouldn't have too many of them, or at least it wouldn't be as bad as present government. So that's how it would be settled if you and I had a dispute as to whose wallet it was.
So
which,
is
carried on case the property rights.
All right, so let me see if I understand this. In the scenario where my court is not one of those courts that agrees to subsume its authority to Court C, right? Not your court, but a court that we mutually agree upon that would adjudicate our discrepancy.
Yes.
Assuming that my court is not one of those, really its legitimacy is just simply a function of how big of an army I have.
Well, I wouldn't say it's a function of how big the army is.
Or how much money I have, because you're saying that I would have to fight everybody and it would go the way of the dodo board if I don't have a dodo bird, if I don't have enough money to support that army that could fight everybody.
Well, I don't think it's either a matter of guns or money. I think the pen is mightier than the sword because the pen determines in which way the sword is pointed. And I think legitimacy is very important. And, you know, the whole society would look upon your court, not you, but your court as sort of as a bandit court and wouldn't have much legitimacy. I mean, even the mafia had some sort of legitimacy.
Okay, but let's say it doesn't. Let's say the society says, we're not going to legitimize your court. And I say, okay, I don't care. I didn't steal your wallet, according to my court, which I think is actually the only legitimate court. Then what happens?
Then it's war. Then we have a little bit of a fight.
So, I mean, I guess for me, what you're outlining is sort of like feudalism to me, right? I mean, and even before we get to that point, what's interesting to me is this notion of like just the idea that you could, I mean, we call it a wallet, but let's say the, you know, a house, or let's say not even a house, a piece of land, something that existed before you claimed ownership to it. When you claim ownership to something, aren't you basically just saying, like, I have a legitimate right to exercise violence in the protection of this area that I have claimed for myself? And you've just sort of, I mean, that seems to me to be contrary to your non-aggression principle.
Well, I would offer you a friendly amendment. It's not so much feudalism. What you should have said is more Hobbesian, you know, Hobbes, where it's a war of all against all. I imagine you'll accept that as a friendly amendment. Feudalism wasn't that warlike, because the king would sort of tell the dukes to, you know, shut up or something.
I imagine that's what would happen, though, in this scenario, right? I mean, because that's what you were saying, is that if we didn't agree to Court C, well, Court C, it sounds like to me, is the king. You and I are the dukes. And there may be other courts that we function in that way, but whatever. I mean, let's continue.
Well, I was just offering a friendly amendment that, you know, it's really the Hobbesian world that you're alluding to, not so much the feudal. But if you want to stick to feudal, that's okay. And also, I agree with you, it doesn't really matter whether it's a wallet or a house or land or anything. I was just using as a wallet as a paradigm case of property that people could dispute over. But I disagree with you. And by the way, this debate that we're now having is a ferocious debate within libertarianism between the minarchists and the anarchists. And you are taking the minarchist point of view. And I will now take the anarchist point of view and say, look, the logical implication of your minarchist libertarian view, I'm glad I've converted you to minarchist libertarianism. I'm just kidding. Right now, China and Colombia are in a state of anarchy with each other. Right now, Brazil and Burundi are in a state of anarchy with each other. Right now, the U.S. and, Australia are in a state of anarchy because there's no world government. And logically, your position, if you say, well, you know, if we have decentralized court, the police systems, you're going to have a Hobbesian or a feudal world. Well, the logical implication of that is we have to have a world government. Because if you're afraid that Court A and F will not abide by Court C, and each one will say, my way or the highway, or, you know, I'm right and the hell with you, well, then we really need a world government, because right now there's anarchy between, I don't know, about 250 countries. And yet, of course, there's a problem with world government. Namely, look, we're both Jewish. And we know that the Jews are wandering Jews. We wander from one place to another because, you know, one dictator doesn't like us much. At least we go somewhere else. A Hitler arises, or what's happening in France arises, and we go to Israel or the United States or somewhere else. But if there were one world government and, China and India, you know, if it was democratic, those two countries would have a big say, and there'd be no place for us Jews to go to. So, and I don't mean to make it just the Jewish thing, but, you know, anyone who is on the outs from the powers that be likes the fact that we have a little bit of decentralization. Whereas you minarchist libertarians, Sam, are, logically implied to favor world government, and I think that that's a problem.
Well, I mean... I don't know that you've really addressed what I said. I think the world is better off for having the UN. I think that there is I wouldn't mind actually, and I don't have a problem with the series of treaties and regimes that we have in the context of those regimes. They're not as enforceable, and then sometimes they do lead to war, and I do think that's problematic. But, things like the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, I agree. There's only so much that in the context of international relations that we can, when we're talking about major countries, that we can really create a regime that that functions, and I think we're doing our best. But that doesn't really, I mean, that doesn't address the idea of property as it speaks now. I mean, when you have the ability, and in fact, you know, look, that's when it is the notion of property and national boundaries, I agree, on some level, is completely arbitrary, right? And it just so happens that's where the Chinese have enforced it through through weapons, and it's the same with the United States, I guess, too. But that doesn't address my question. How does the non-aggression principle reconcile itself with the idea that you can claim ownership of something? Because it is only that ownership, that property right that you exercise, is simply basically your way of saying, I have the ability to be aggressive if you attempt to take what I have decided is mine.
Well, you're sort of, I think, veering dangerously close to the argument of might makes right and accusing me of favoring that view that might makes right. But I don't uphold that view. My view is that there's justice and there's right, and sometimes justice and righteousness lose out in the war. I mean, you know, sometimes the bad guys win, unhappily. So I don't think that might makes right. I think
where
that
do property rights come from is really what I'm asking, I think. And how does that not involve aggression?
Well, you know, you have to distinguish between violence and aggression, or violence and invasive aggression. I mean, libertarians are not pacifists. We don't believe, well, some might be pacifists, but you need not be a pacifist to be a libertarian. You can believe in self-defense or other defense. You know, if I come after you with a knife, you have a right to shoot me because I'm violating your property rights in your person.
But wait a second. That's what's interesting to me, is that your personal integrity is a property right. That seems to me to be fairly arbitrary. I mean, if I take a knife, let's say, and walk onto your property and stab your ground, I don't think that that is the same as coming at you as a human being. But it seems like you're saying that those are the same things.
Well, I wouldn't say they're the same. I would say that they're both property rights. One is a much more important property right of mine, me, my body. And if you put a knife into my body, you're really violating a very, very important piece of my property right. On the other hand, if you just step on my lawn and maybe throw a knife into my lawn, well, yeah, I think you've also violated my property rights, but a much less important property right of mine.
Well, let me ask you this. We all – I will, for the sake of argument, call them both property rights. But one is a property right that every single human being has, which is their own person by definition.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
The property right to what you consider your property, that to me seems to be not inherent in every person, because every person doesn't own a piece of land. So I'm curious. It's quite obvious how the first one is arrived at, because everybody is a human being. They are themselves. It's quite clear as to who they are. But how is it that you establish that you own this land without it being a function of violence?
Okay, well, let me answer it in this way, and I think that's a very important question. First, I don't know if it's a concession or not on your part. I think maybe it's not, but it's a very important point that you made, that we each own ourselves, because there are people who deny this. For example, the Nazis denied that Jews and gays and Romani and blacks and non-Aryans really own themselves. And the issue of slavery, there were some people who said that other people really don't own themselves, but we own them. And in the case of rape. The rapist, in effect, is saying to the rape victim, you know, you don't really own, or at least all the property rights in your person. I own some of them, namely the right to abuse you in this sexual way. So that's a very important point. And from this, libertarians would deduce that slavery is an abomination, that kidnapping is an abomination, that rape is an abomination. But but the point is that I have a right to self-defense. So again, I'm making you the bad guy. I hope you don't mind. First, I accuse you of stealing my wallet. Now I'll accuse you of coming at me with a knife, as I did before. Now, if you come at me with a knife with the intent to stab me, you're in effect saying that I don't have a right to exist, namely that you own me, in effect, that you can determine what happens to me. And I can use violence. So libertarians are not against violence. I can use violence to ward off your attack. And so therefore, property rights imply violence, not only property rights in land and in wallets and in houses, but even in persons. Namely, suppose that there's this African guy and there's this person, white person, who wants to enslave him and bring him to the United States. They're both using violence, only I would say one is using justified violence, namely defensive violence, and the other is using aggressive violence. And libertarians are only against aggressive violence. So that would be one point. The other point is, well, how do you get to own non-person property or non-human property? And here libertarians pretty much rely on John Locke, another famous philosopher, along with Hobbes. And what Locke said is, if you mix your labor with the land, you sort of imprint your personality on the land. So you go out, and you sort of homestead and you put in a crop and you take care of the land. You knock down a few trees, you get rid of a few rocks, and you put in a cornfield or something. Well, then you own that land. That would be the libertarian defense of that.
Well, there's a couple things that stick out. One is, I think that from my perspective, calling one's personhood property is really sort of a semantics game that I think falls apart when you talk about, like, my right to exist. Because when I trespass on your property, from your perspective, I'm not questioning the right of that piece of land to exist. I'm just questioning your dominance over that land, which is clearly not a part of you. But how is it? I mean, if it's simply just a question of when you mix your labor with that property, it becomes yours. Does that mean that if someone, I guess, inherits it, or if someone just, just doesn't do anything with the property, then there's no property right vested in it?
Well, no. I would say that Robert Nozick is sort of my guru or my mentor on this one. He talks about legitimate title transfers to property, and he says that any voluntary transfer is legitimate. For example, I put in this corn crop, and you domesticate a cow, and you capture the cow, and you domesticate the cow, and now you get some milk out of the cow. And now what happens, I trade you some corn for some milk, and now I own the milk even though I didn't produce it, and you own the corn even though you didn't produce that. And yet I would say, along with Nozick and every other libertarian, that I now have a legitimate title to the milk because I can trace it back to an agreement with you to trade, have this barter, and also to original homesteading. Namely, you're the legitimate owner of the milk because you domesticated the cow, and I'm the legitimate owner of the corn because I, homesteaded the cornfield. So that would be one legitimate title transfer trade. Another one would be gifts. I give some corn to you as a birthday present. Or I give my son the cornfield as inheritance. That's just a gift after death or a gift as you're passing away. Or gambling. I bet you on the Super Bowl and I lose and you get some corn. I bet you some corn against some milk. And that would be another legitimate title transfer. But the point is, suppose I now, homestead the cornfield, and then I go away for a year or so, do I have to keep homesteading it? And that's a debate among libertarians, and in my view is, once you own it, period. And there's a very technical issue. Well, suppose you go away for 50 years, then, do you give up ownership? And I would say that's a very esoteric point among libertarians. But you can have, absentee landlords or absentee landowners. In other words, I I homestead the cornfield, and now what I do is I rent it out to you. You're my farmer person. I make an arrangement with you. I'll let you you put the corn in. It's my field, but you put the corn in, and you give me half the crop or something like that. You're a sharecropper. That would be a legitimate contract.
Professor, according to what you're saying, that the vast swaths of this country are illegitimately considered property.
Do you want to elaborate a little bit on that?
Well, I mean, the Native Americans.
Yes, Native. Now you've elaborated enough. You've said Native
and
Americans.
I would also argue that, you know, I mean, when we're talking, I mean, I guess, you know, all. I mean, accordingly, you know, if we're using illegitimate labor, i.e., slaves, to homestead property, that also seems to be questionable.
Oh, I wouldn't say questionable. I would say very
in terms of in terms of property.
Yes, very unjustified. Now, I've had a debate with I forget the guy's name. A Jewish guy, a Second Thoughts guy. Do you know who that is?
No.
It's right at the tip of my tongue. I can't. Horowitz. I forget his first name. It has to do with reparations to black people for slavery. Now, in my view, and I think most of the terms would agree with me, and I think you'd probably agree with me on property rights, what should have happened in 1865 is that they should have declared slavery ex post facto illegal, just as we did in Nuremberg trials. We should have made those slave owners slaves of the slaves, but, you know, they've escaped our justice because we can't go back to 1865. But what should have happened with those big plantations? Well, if there were 500 slaves on the plantation X in South Carolina somewhere, what should have happened is that the 5,000 acres should have been divided up into 500 plots, and each slave should have got, 10 acres or whatever the numbers come out. Instead, that plantation went to the slave owner's son. And now in South Carolina, there's some, let's say it hasn't been sold, there's some great-great-grandson of the slave owner, a white guy, who owns that plantation. And I would say that the slave, the great-grandchildren, some guy, a black guy, say, living in Harlem, who was the grandson of the slave, should, in justice, go to the court and say, hey, you know, the white grandson isn't a criminal. He's just the recipient of stolen property. But that property should go to me. And no, I think you would agree with me on that, would you not?
I think there is I think there's certainly an argument for reparations along those lines. I mean, I think but my point is that and when we talk about Native Americans as well, we're looking at an entire property regime in this country that, according to you, is illegitimate.
Yes, well, it's the same principle, only there's some slight difference, because when the white man came to North America, the estimates are that there were about 2 million Native Indians or Native persons, and right now there are, I think, 350 million people in the United States, and it's still pretty empty. The point, if you take a plane.
Well, but I mean, we've already determined, right, that if you planted something on that soil, you own it. And so it's not even just actually living there. It sounds like anything that you've done to alter it creates your property. And it, I mean, it seems to me like everything that we have in terms of property rights in this country is illegitimate. I suppose it's possible that a small percentage of the property rights in this country are legitimate, I suppose. But it seems to me that that opens up a whole nother sort of like argument that like we could empower our government today to involve in all sorts of takings of that property in one form or another, because none of those property rights are actually legitimate in any fashion.
Well, I think you've got a very good attempt at a reductio ad absurdum of my principle, and I applaud you for it. And there are libertarians who take that exact view, but I beg to differ.
Well, what and, show me how what breaks down in my reductio ad absurdum?
Reductio ad absurdum.
Sorry.
No problem. I mispronounce things too. It's just
sort of my
numbers.
Trademark.
Right. Okay. Well, all geniuses do this. No problem. I think that in logic, you're impeccable. You're absolutely right. And I fully agree with you. The only problem, the only caveat I have with your reductio ad absurdum is just the numbers. And I was starting in to respond to that. And the point I'm making now is right now there are 350, roughly, million Americans. And if you take a plane from, I don't know, St. Louis to San Francisco and you go west of the Mississippi and you look down at night, the place is bloody empty. The place is empty. And even east of the Mississippi, it's not all that full. There's plenty of space. Now imagine how, and that's 350 million people, but assuming that when the white man came, there were only 2 million Indians in all of the U.S. Present territory and maybe Canada too, they couldn't occupy anything like 98% of the land. They couldn't have homesteaded all that. So what I would say is, yes, they should have, you know, the typical Indian tribe would have a southern area, say in Arizona, and it'd be, I don't know, 10 square miles.
Well, Professor, then, forgive me. I mean, there's really no way for us to do this. But, I mean, we've already argued at this point if you chop down a tree, and we know that natives cross this entire land, undoubtedly chopping down trees. Now, we could argue it's 40%. They were able to cover 40% of the country, or it could be 80% or 75%. I mean, whatever that figure is, and you increase it over time, it seems to me that let's assume that it's just a figure. You want to call it 30%? Let's call it 30%.
I want to call it 0.5%.
Really? So you don't think that they chopped a tree? I mean, you know, like when you go and homestead, you don't necessarily put a piece of corn on every single piece of that property, right? I mean, when you you don't necessarily even put a – is it just the fence, everything that's included within that fence? Or is it – do you need to put something on every square inch of that property according to the way that you legitimately acquire property? In other words,
I'm going to say something now, and I don't want you to take it in the wrong way, but I really want to give you a compliment, and I want to say that you're a very brilliant young man. I think you're younger than me, so I'll say younger young man. This is exactly the debate that libertarians involve themselves in, namely, how intensive does the farming have to be in order to count as homesteading? For example, if you put a fence around the whole United States, do you own all that's in there? No. On the other hand, do you have to put a corn plant every square inch? No. How about every square foot? Well, maybe. And east of the Mississippi, a little bit more intensive than west of the Mississippi, because east of Mississippi, more.
Is this really,
water, you know.
Professor, be honest with me. Is this really the big debate amongst libertarians? Because it seems to me, I mean, with all due respect, because, like, I mean, the reason why I feel like I'm indulging in this line of question is because if we can get to a number that we can relatively agree upon, and you can tell me how you get to that half, 0.5%, but if we can get to a number that is 30%, 40%, 20%, seems to me, then any argument that we have government taxation or regulation that inhibits things to 20 or 30%, if that's already our starting point with libertarianism, I'm feeling really good about that. Because at the end of the day, I don't really care about the philosophical underpinnings of this stuff. I'm looking for policies in the real world that I think are good. So if you're going to say it's 0.5%, 2 million based upon 300 million today. I'm just curious, what is it? Where do you fall on that? Is it the fence? Is it every yard you need to have a corn? Do you need to chop a tree every 6 feet or 12 feet? Or how does that work?
Well, I'm trying to explain that to you.
Oh.
But before I do, let me just say that we're now we're agreeing on the principle. I agree with you that if the native Indians homesteaded 40% of the land, or 60 or 80% or whatever it is, then they should have 40 or 60 or 80% of the land. So we have no dispute.
I'm just stipulating,
on principle.
Make no mistake, I'm just stipulating for, you know, to explore your philosophy.
Oh, I see. Okay, well, then provisionally. I should put the word provisionally. Look, we agree on 100% of the slave lands, do we not? Those plantations that were really homesteaded by the slaves under the whip of the overseers?
That I actually think that the reparations should be broader than those people, direct descendants, frankly. But
okay. Well, we have that. You see, the argument this guy Horowitz argued with a black scholar at Harvard, I think, who said, I think what you're now saying is that, you know, all whites owe all blacks something for slavery. And here I agree with Horowitz, who says, well, you know, there were a lot of blacks who came after slavery was over. Why should they get anything? And there were a lot of whites, Jews, for example, who never had slaves. And also there were blacks who had slaves. So I wouldn't go any further than that. But I think you and I agree on 100% of the land, at least. We agree
well,
on that.
I
you
wouldn't
want to go further.
I don't get there for the same reasons you do. But that's not important in the context of this. I'm just curious as to, like, how, you know, I was just pursuing a question as to how it is that you perceive property rights, not the exercise of property rights. And I'm talking about the property rights that aren't innate to one by being born, okay? How you exercise those property rights without exercising aggression, because, you know, I walk into a house, if I don't recognize it's your house, and or better yet, let's just keep it a piece of land. I walk onto this piece of land, I don't recognize your authority, wherever it comes from, to own that land, and you attack me. As far as I'm concerned, you're being aggressive. But you're saying the way that I have got the authority to own that land is because I've worked it, because I've mixed my labor with it. And now I'm asking you, okay, what are the parameters of that? Because, hey, you're about to exercise violence on me, aggression on me, but you're saying the reason why it's not aggressive is because you have a legitimate claim to that property, and I'm trying to figure out, how did you get that legitimate claim? You tell me by working it, and I go, what do you mean?
Right. Now, it's a fair question. And by the way, how I get the 0.5% is I put 2 million Indians in the numerator, and I put 350 million people in the denominator, and I get 2/350, which is, I don't know, 1/3% or something like that. Just a rough and ready estimate.
So it would have been better for the Native Americans to have this conversation 100 years ago.
Well, no, even 100 years ago, they never owned more than 2% of anything because there were so few of them, and they couldn't possibly homestead vast
areas.
Well,
wait a second. Your numerator changes, though, right? I mean, 100 years ago.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. No. The numerator changes 100. In other words, there were 2 million Indians when we white people, I don't think your ancestors of mine were there then, but when we white people came, there were 2 million. We killed an awful lot of them, so the numerator decreases, but I'm willing to keep the numerator up to as many people as there were before they were slaughtered by the white people.
That's mighty white of you, as we would say.
So to speak. You should say so to speak. Look, the point is, as to the intensivity or the extensivity of the homesteading, it depends upon the culture. East of the Mississippi, you have to be more intensive. West of the Mississippi, less intensive. When we go to the moon and we start using the Lockean homesteading theory, we would even be less intensive because it's a desert. So, you just chop down a tree every 20 feet there are no trees on the moon. But the point is that east of the Mississippi, you have to plant those corn plants as the way most people plant the corn plants. Namely, it's based on the culture. And I guess that's every foot or every yard or something like that.
Well, what if the Native American culture was such that, you know, we just walk across it and anything that we can see?
Too bad. Too bad on them. That's not libertarian. Anything you can see. Then Columbus, there were no Indians where Columbus was, and he gets up on a big ladder and he sees 100 square miles. Well, if that's his culture, the libertarians would
just
reject
saying
it.
If they're the first ones to see it, or
too
we
bad.
Use it as part of our, I cut down this tree here so that I can see the valley. Haven't I worked it? Haven't I mixed that view shed with my labor?
No. Vision is not good enough to own things. You have to actually mix your labor with the land.
But we still are. And that depends on which side of the Mississippi you're on as to what that is.
Well,
I mean, this doesn't seem like a system to me. It seems a little bit arbitrary.
Well, there's a system here if you look at it more sympathetically. Namely, you look at how the people actually farm. And let's say they come from Ireland, and how or Britain or France or wherever, and how do they farm there? Well, they put plants, corn plants, every foot. Well, then, given that the eastern Mississippi is sort of like France in terms of having a certain amount of water, well, then you follow that policy. So there is a system, and the system does not allow you to own as far as you can see, and it doesn't allow you to own, you know, you put a corn plant every acre. You put a corn plant every acre, you own the foot around each corn plant, but you don't own the whole acre. So there is a system. It's, I wouldn't say it's arbitrary, but I would say it's a continuous sort of a thing. Mm. We have a continuum problem. Let me talk about the continuum problem for a second, if I may.
Sure.
If you go to bed with a 5-year-old girl, you're guilty of statutory rape, even if she agrees, because we don't think that she is capable of agreement. On the other hand, if you go to bed with a 25-year-old woman and she agrees, we don't think it's statutory rape, because we think that the women of 25 years old are perfectly capable of giving consent. Well, what about the 15-year-old girl? Oh, what about the 14 or the 16? You know, where is the right point to have statutory rape? And the answer coming from me, and I think most people, is it's sort of a continuum. It's arbitrary. If you pick 15 years and 6 months, well, how about 15 years and 7 months? There's no one right answer. And that's the sort of a thing that is occurring in how intensive or extensive does the homesteading have to be. You just can't say, well, it has to be this extensive or it has to be that. But we know that a 5-year-old girl is way over on one side of the line and a 25-year-old girl is way over on the other side of the line, just as we know that if you put one plant every square mile, you're not homesteading. And if you put one plant every foot than you are. And well, how about every half acre, or how about every quarter acre? It's a continuum problem.
See,
there's no right answer,
now,
or rather, there's no non-arbitrary answer, but it's not an arbitrary system.
See, I think this gets to the heart of one of the things that I find most problematic about libertarianism, is that I agree with you. The where we draw the line in terms of statutory rape is arbitrary. It's simply in our society, we find it at one point. In another society or at another time, it could be at a different point. It is a determination that is made in many respects by, I mean, I guess sort of it is arbitrary and subjective. And that's the thing that I ultimately find about libertarianism, is that at the end of it, once you get down to the basis, someone has decided or someone has decided on what measure, arbitrarily or based upon, you know, and by arbitrarily, I'm not saying whimsically, but I'm saying based upon whatever their culture says, that this is going to be the legitimate property right in this instance, or this is going to be the legitimate use of aggression. And it is arbitrary. And despite the fact that libertarians ultimately say this is simply just a logical construct, at one point it's just where a libertarian wants to decide to sort of plant the flag. In this case, this is where we're going to decide property is legitimate. And this is where we're going to decide that the use of force is legitimate. And that's why I think, you know, I mean, to a certain extent, I find it, you know, it's interesting to talk about, but it's really just not useful beyond the fact that we've decided on X and that's what X is going to be. And, you know, I think that is, you know, often like a function of a democracy, and hopefully the democracy is working. I think there are times where we can have calculations made because there's a failure of democracy. But again, that's just my arbitrary perspective. And then, you know, you let it hash out. But it seems like libertarians try and rely on some sense that there's a logical these things follow logically. But at the end of the day, you've got to just make an arbitrary decision.
Well, I think if I'm going to convert you to libertarianism, it's going to be consequentialist or utilitarian libertarianism, not deontological, because even though you do have a flair for the logic and the reductio ad absurdum, I think at bottom you're really a consequentialist or utilitarian. And by that, I don't mean to criticize you.
Oh, I don't take it as one.
No, good, good. In our email, we said we would talk about other things besides property, and all so far
we've only talked about property.
We were going to talk about vaccinations or minimum wage or things like that, but we're almost out of time, so we're probably not going to get to that. But I just wanted to say that I hope you invite me back on your program, because most of the interviews I do are with libertarians doing the finer points of libertarianism, and which is roughly what we did today. But I think in future, if we discuss other issues such as vaccinations or minimum wage or whatever, you won't be roughly being so interested in internal libertarian discussions. And another point is, you see, I've been defending the anarchist libertarian position, and you don't much like that. I think if I'm going to convert you to libertarianism, it's going to be as a minarchist, because then minarchists believe in democracy, they believe in national governments, they believe in all these sorts of things. And the solution to how intensive or extensive the homesteading would have to be under the minarchist or the constitutionalist would be, well, the Supreme Court ultimately, or maybe each state court, and I think that would be something you'd be much more comfortable with.
Certainly more comfortable than not, but I would even go even beyond minarchists to what we needists is what I basically come down.
That's a good one. What we needists.
Let's touch on vaccines. It's been in the news. I don't know. I know that in the past that you were an advisor for Congressman Ron Paul. I don't know if you're an advisor to Senator Rand Paul, but he had some comments about vaccines the other day. And I'm curious as to what your perspective is on vaccinations.
Well, with all due respect to you, not as a philosopher, but as a as a radio host, we've only got a few minutes, and that issue is probably worth a whole hour too. But since you ask, I'll give you the 1 minute answer. And that is that among libertarians, there's a big dispute. Oh, yes, I am sort of an indirect advisor to Rand Paul as well through one of his top lieutenants. My view is that at least in some cases, now I don't know about measles, it would depend upon the specifics, that it would be justified to compel people to have vaccinations or inoculations or whatever, whereas most libertarians, Rand Paul and Ron Paul and pretty much everyone who writes for LouRockwell.com and whoever writes for Target Liberty, they take a different view than me, and they take the view that it's up to the parent or something like that.
Oh, so you this is all sort of stipulated on the notion that vaccinations are safe, obviously there's some people disagree. I don't, but that vaccinations are safe. So you have no problem. And when you advise Rand Paul on this or through one of his lieutenants, as you say, is it on libertarian terms or is it just simply on public policy terms?
Both.
What is the libertarian terms?
Well, the way on vaccinations, you're asking?
Yeah.
Well, to me, take the case of Typhoid Mary. Now, Typhoid Mary lacked mens rea. Mens rea is like a guilty conscience. She wasn't trying to give people typhoid. She didn't even know she had typhoid, but she was in some sort of restaurant or food bank or whatever, and she was giving people typhoid. So the question is, do we forget about anarchist libertarianism for the moment? Does the government, a legitimate, limited government, have the right to go to her and say, look, Typhoid Mary, you are not a murderer, or at least not a first-degree murderer because you lack intent, but you are engaging in manslaughter, and we've got to stop you. Now, you're not guilty. You're not a bad guy, so we're not going to put you in jail. We're going to put you in a nice hotel room or something, and we'll feed you and give you a TV set if they had TVs in those days or whatever, and we'll get you food and clothing or whatever. But you got to stay out of circulation. You've got to be quarantined as long as you have it. Would they be justified in doing that? I would say yes. And I extrapolate from that and say, look, measles, Mary, you now have measles, and there are certain people who can't be inoculated, like pregnant women and babies under the age of 1 year old. And if you, you know, go out into the streets, you're going to give these people measles or mumps or whatever it is, rubella. And some of these people are going to die. And do we have a right to use violence against you defensively? Because remember, we're not pacifists. And I would say yes.
Wow.
But
well,
Sam,
Professor, I got to say, I think you and I are in agreement on that. And it really,
hey.
I think it puts into relief on some level. I mean, because I consider, I mean, you are by your own accord on the most pure end of the spectrum of libertarians. And it seems to me you're significantly more moderate on this point than Rand Paul.
Well, I wouldn't say moderate. I would say I'm more
reasonable,
compatible, or consistent with the libertarian principle than he is. But again, I'm in the distinct minority among libertarians. Most libertarians wouldn't agree with me. But again, I don't say that it's true in the case of measles. I would say if the science were clear, and I'm not scientist enough. But Sam, I got to get off.
Oh yes, okay.
On
Professor,
1 hour.
Thank you so much.
And as I say, I hope you invite me again because I really enjoyed this, and I'd like to get out and talk to people that don't agree with me also.
Well, I appreciate your coming on, and I'm sure we will talk again soon.
Great. Have a good day.
Bye bye. Well, so there it is. We finished on a point of agreement.
This was a lot of fun.
I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I mean, the I hope it's fair that I comment on these. I imagine that he's commenting in his various forums on this. But the idea that property rights are legitimate, that come down to the distance between where you plant the corn or you chop down a tree, and that is a function of which side of the Mississippi River you were on, I think sort of, in my mind, illustrates the point that I have been making over and over again to libertarians who call in, is that at one point or another, you're making an arbitrary decision. And you could say I'm doing it on the mores of corn planting in France, or I am doing it on the methodology of trailblazing by Irish Scotsmen, not Native Americans, but you're still arbitrarily saying, hey, this is where I decide property rights will be legitimate, and then my use of force will be legitimate. And of course, I also think that the idea that we're going to have at least we're all going to have our own individual courts, or we're going to sign up for courts, and then those courts will band together and agree to go to other courts, which I guess presumably will go to other courts. And it's all at the end of the day just going to be cemented by who can afford it. I don't think that's a recipe for a very good society. But I would submit that they basically tried this back in the in what Matt would call the Game of Thrones days.
The whole time during that interview, I just have in a loop in my head now, like, that would depend on acorn acreage in the pre-colonial settlement.
All right, we're going to take a break. Head into the fun half where I will take your phone calls at 646-257-3920. To get your feelings, and we have a lot of IMs to read about this debate. We'll be right back.
with scarves of red tied round their throats to keep their little heads from falling in the snow. And I turn round and there you go, and Michael, you would fall and turn the white snow red as strawberries in summer.
We are back on the Majority Report. My name is Matt Binder.
I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Mark Ames. He's a senior editor at Pando. How you doing, Mark?
Good. How you doing?
Doing really well, man. And I should just say, as a heads up to our listeners, Mark is joining us from the field. And by field, I mean a park by his apartment where he is needed to and has been so generous, frankly, to sort of get away from his family and his amazing newborn to join us for a little while. So appreciate it, man.
Yeah, sure. Thank you. You know, my son has already said he's going to remember you forever for this. But
really?
Oh, yeah.
Well,
he has a long memory.
I love it.
Pissed off.
Yeah, well, of course he's pissed off. I appreciate that. So there'll be some. We could make probably some type of like gangster grudge match vehicle about, you know,
there you go.
Between me and your son. I'm open to it.
Be careful. He's big. He's already big. So be careful.
Dude, I'm careful, but I'm crafty. So you have this really, really interesting new piece in Pando called Seymour Hersh and the Dangers of Corporate Muckraking. And what I liked so much about this piece is it hits a lot of themes that you hit a lot, Mark, which is sort of like really sort of shedding light on why is it easier on both the left and right to sort of expose government malfeasance, which is important. You're in no way diminishing or undermining the importance of those stories. But there's also this corporate power, this corporate corollary, and all of these issues we talk about that isn't addressed in the same way. Is that another kid?
It is. It's yeah. Park here.
Okay, cool. Yeah. So you explained Seymour Hersh. The way the story starts is basically in Seymour Hersh's sort of heyday in the 1970s. He's exposed the My Lai massacre. He's at the New York Times, and he wants to take on corporate power. Take us from there.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was just, it started with me actually being curious. Why hasn't this, you know, the most bloodthirsty, aggressive, impressive muckraker, as they call him of our time. Like, why hasn't he gone after corporate private power the way he has after government public power, knowing that muckraking, you know, the original muckrakers went almost, you know, more so than after government power, they went after private corporate power, which
right.
rose up in the late 19th century. Rockefeller, Standard Oil, the coal companies, so on and so forth. And so I wondered that, and I looked, and there is actually a story about what happened. Seymour Hersh, you know, he was considered hit politically very much on the left. Abe Rosenthal used to call him my little commie, sort of ironically, affectionately in the newsroom at the New York Times. And it turned out that Hersh himself decided after, you know, after the My Lai expose and after the really big expose on CIA domestic spying in 75, the MH chaos program, in which the CIA illegally, you know, spied on probably up to hundreds and thousands of Americans,
right.
Leading to the Church Committee and all that. He said after that, okay, the next big story in the next 10 years is corporate power. And, you know, the thing you have to remember is that back then, and his biographer talked about this too, in the 70s, the basic assumptions were very different about, private corporate power versus government power. The basic assumption, people were far more openly, and the culture was more openly skeptical of, and if not hostile towards corporate power.
Right.
And it was much more on the front and center of people's thoughts. You know, today you have all these like bizarre assumptions that somehow private power, corporate power, is not as dangerous as government power. As if, for example, one of the falsehoods I hear a lot, oh, well, companies, private companies can't put you behind bars the way a government can. That's just BS. I mean,
they
operate
private prisons, for God's sake.
Exactly.
Yeah.
No, they operate them, but they constantly work with law enforcement to put people behind bars all the time. I mean,
right.
I wrote about eBay doing this. Like the head of the security for eBay at one conference with with a bunch of police and FBI people bragged about how eBay in just a short period of time had put away, you know, thousands of arrests around the globe with their global security force. Anybody who knows anything about the PayPal 14 knows that eBay PayPal ran the prosecution. I mean, it's a pretty shocking case if you ever read it. They ran the whole prosecution of that case against the PayPal 14.
So circling back to Hirsch for a minute, to get back to the story. Yeah. I think that that's a really interesting point, though, just a side note, that he, in the 70s, even with this very different attitude, he was anticipating the environment and the climate of the 70s and 80s, which would set the stage for the assumptions you're talking about today, which was the kind of neoliberal backlash, and that was the sort of empowerment of corporations. So he saw it as a perceptive muckraker and journalist in the 1970s.
He had a nose for where coercive power was, and coercive power is both in the, you know, in the military and in intelligence areas in the government, and then in these, you know, huge new growing corporations. And so he chose to go after what was a very infamous company of its time in the 60s and 70s called Gulf and Western.
Gulf and Western to us a little bit. I mean, you got this mafia-connected lawyer who's involved in it. It's amazing. I mean, just bring out that company a little bit. Bring it to life a little bit. And because it's also just a great target for anybody who has a sense of what a good story is. I mean, it's mind-blowing, the power and reach of this company and the intimacy between, you know, the criminal economy and the corporate economy. There's a lot to it.
And the characters. I mean, it had great characters. And it shows, again, you know, that Hirsch has always had a great nose for a good story. The problem, as I'll tell you in a minute, was what happens when you try to write about corporate power. You have to bring in the lawyers and the editors in a way you don't have to when you write about government. So in any event, Gulf and Western began in the 50s as an auto parts company. And it was run by this guy who was the New Yorker in the 90s after he was dead, called the last great business eccentric. His name was Charlie Bluedorn. He was also known as the Mad Austrian. He was originally from Austria. He, you know, had a lot of energy. And he was, you know, notoriously aggressive as hell and scary. And he wound up striking up basically a really good relationship first with Chase Bank and then Hanover Manhattan, I think was the other one. Mm-hmm. Manufacturers Hanover, I'm sorry. And these banks basically, they open up the spigot for him to finance an acquisition spree. And the banks made money kind of on both ends because the more – like they would have clients on one end and then Gulf and Western on the other end, and they would make money off both ends on the deals. So they were encouraged to really keep financing these acquisitions that he would make. And he wanted to do it because his stock price would go, the more he would acquire, the more value his company had, and the more his stock price went up, and the more leverage he would then get over the banks to pull out personal loans. I mean, it was a very, very convoluted and fraud-ridden.
It sounds very moderate.
It does, but you know, you start to think about what the banks did here in the 2000s, or what the SNLs did. I mean, they basically load up on borrowed money and then turn it into their personal ATM. That's kind of what he did,
right?
With Gulf and Western, and you know, he really attracted a lot of attention when he bought Paramount Pictures in '66, I think. Mm-hmm. And then in 68, he attracted more attention when he cut this very strange deal with one of the most notorious mafia financiers, you know, of the 20th century, Michele Sindona. Michele Sindona he ran the money laundering for the Sicilian Mafia's global heroin operations. He was also known as God's banker because he had the ear of one of the popes, and he managed the Vatican's global properties. He also helped the CIA move money around the world. And in 68, 69, he cut a deal with Gulf and Western, which, by the way, was considered – Gulf and Western was so aggressive that Wall Street nicknamed them Engulf and Devour. And if you've ever seen that Mel Brooks movie, Silent Movie, the evil corporation in it was called Engulf and Devour. It was a movie from the mid-70s.
Right.
In any event, So you know, one of the one of the companies, subsidiaries that Gulf and Western bought, I think it was called Commercial something or other. Anyway, some New Hampshire company. It was totally worthless, and it was creating a problem for the books, you know, for Gulf and Western's books. So somehow they managed to swap I can't remember how many millions of dollars worth of totally worthless commercial paper in the subsidiary with Michele Sindona's Italian finance company, 10% stake in that company. And then they swapped back half of Paramount Pictures' movie lot back to Sindona. And then they asked Sindona about it afterwards, and he said, I like to give pieces of companies undervalued to friends who I want to do favors for. I mean, it just makes, like, no sense whatsoever.
Unless you're a Sicilian financier, then that might make some sense.
Yes, exactly. And so, you know, this was just one of the many shady schemes that Hirsch wound up getting into. Another one is they own basically the largest employer in the Dominican Republic, where, you know, the U.S. Has been intervening militarily and otherwise, you know, throughout the whole century. And they basically, I mean, they own the sugar business there, Gulf and Western did. They own the sugar refinery. They were the largest employer. And they, when the Dominican Republic Central Bank needed more money on its books, Gulf and Western would illegally funnel money their way against SEC rules. And when Gulf and Western needed more money on its books, you know, to try to boost the share, the Dominican Republic Central Bank would funnel money back into their accounts. It was all just, it was crazy. So
you have everything. You have mafia. Yeah. You have incredible, just sort of rampant corporate criminality. You have our policy of coup and dictatorship in Latin America. And then seeing the trend of corporate power. So Hirsch sees all of this, and this is going to be his next major expose.
Exactly. So he goes to the New York Times and says, this is going to be the big story. Like, I've already proven I have a nose for this stuff. I have a Pulitzer. Corporate power, and this company embodies everything that's wrong with overweening corporate power in this country. These guys are now the 19th largest employers. They're violating every rule in the book. They're not using the money to sort of innovate and grow and, I mean, you know, and do something good. They're actually just using the money as personal ATMs. And so he gets to go ahead. Everybody's totally for it. And he winds up hooking up with Jeff Gerth, who's now ProPublica. Mm-hmm. I think he did like the Whitewater. I think he first broke the Whitewater stories in the 90s. Anyway, and they wound up spending, you know, a very long time digging into Gulf and Western and all of the problems they're having. And there was a lot of buildup, like, oh, my God, Hirsch is going after corporate America now. And there's a lot of, like, anticipation of the story, what would happen when it finally came out. And in mid-1977, they finally released a series. It was a three-part series, 13,000 words in total. And it landed with a whimper, an absolute whimper. The stories are dull, turgid. Everything a Seymour Hirsch story is not, you know. And then you start going back into, well, why? How did that happen? Why did the stories have so little effect, and why are they so unreadable and such a disappointment? And then we found out the whole process Hirsch had to go through to even get these stories published. And what happens is, I mean, when you're a journalist and you want to go after a company, first of all, companies can do a lot more to journalists. They can threaten you in far bigger and worse ways overtly. Yeah,
explain that a little bit. That's because I think people, again, intuitively, they'd say, well, wait a second. If you're going up against the NSA or the CIA or, you know, a covert intelligence or military organization that has, you know, vast surveillance powers, is involved in all sorts of extrajudicial things, how can a corporation have more overt power? It makes total sense to me, but, you know, tease that out a little bit.
Well, I mean, first of all, they're considered people,
right? There you
right,
go.
And you know, under our laws, and the government is constrained by the Constitution. The government is constrained by the Constitution that, you know, that's what we're all, you know, worried about these days. That, you know, it shouldn't be able to surveil you. I mean, somebody can hire a private detective,
right?
Right, and it's legal. Maybe you can sue them, but you can't. if you can, you know, if you can prove some kinds of damages to your life, you can maybe sue them.
Really quick. So basically, just I mean, I want you to fill it, but like an example would be like if the FBI or the CIA send people to follow and monitor a journalist who's covering them, that's a big deal. A corporation can hire any private contractor they want to do anything they want to, I mean, short of obviously like physical harm, but they can go through somebody's garbage. They can, you know, that's par for the course.
Well, and as Hirsch and the people writing about Hirsch's story said in the 70s as well, the things that Gulf and Western said and did, I mean, they openly threatened Hirsch many times. They did everything to try to get him and Jedgert fired. They openly told Hirsch, you know, we're digging up information on your families and on Jedgert's father that's going to be very damaging. They told him that straight up. No fear whatsoever. Now, and as they said at the time, everybody said, if that happened in the government, you'd have resignation. You'd have a huge ongoing, you know, story, and then you'd have people resigning. Nobody in private government, you know, let's call them private government, that's what they are, resigns over that. And they don't, and, you know, it's assumed these days, our cultural assumption is that they're only, you know, fealty is only to, then their only responsibility is to their shareholders to maximize profit. They don't have any responsibility to, you know, to the public whatsoever. And they don't have to. They're not constrained by the Constitution. So, so you know, what Hirsch found out was that going after these guys, the threats of lawsuits were so great. I mean, the NSA, you know, the CIA couldn't threaten didn't threaten to sue, you know, the New York Times over Hirsch exposing the, you know, the domestic spying program. They weren't going to, like, sue the New York Times out of existence. And, in fact, the New York Times had already won, you know, landmark First Amendment rights cases in the Supreme Court about its right to publish the Pentagon Papers and other classified documents. So, you know, the New York Times knew that it's protected against the public government power, but it's not protected. And we all know this. Every journalist knows this. Every journalist knows that, you know, you might fear in the back of your head that the government could do something secretly without you ever knowing that could screw up your life, you know, or there's a fear that they'll kill you or, you know, whatever. But we know that they are actually constrained and they can't get away with it. But with private corporations, first of all, you can't FOIA them. Right. You know, and good luck suing them. I mean, what's Jeff Gerst going to do? Sue Gulf and Western for threatening him? You know, who's got the money for that? Right. These guys were clearly ready to go all out to make life hell for them, and they did. And so the New York Times, unlike any of his stories on the CIA or the My Lai massacre or anything, they held up his story. They made it go through. They had lawyers vetting it in ways that none of his stories about government were vetted. They had editors. They put a team of editors on it. They were threatened, you know, repeatedly. Hirsch himself said that the experience from Gulf and Western's executives and their lawyers and the abuse that he put up with and the threats that he put up with was unlike anything by far that he had ever dealt with when investigating the CIA or the military. He'd never dealt with anything like it. And he didn't want to repeat the experience again. He was destroyed by it. Yeah. The article came out like crap. And he just thought, you know, as a career move, it's a bad career move. It's not worth it to fight corporate power. And so he never wrote about corporations again after that. He went back to writing about Henry Kissinger. You know, we all hate Henry Kissinger. And there's no fear of, you know, of the sort of retaliation that he had to deal with when writing about you know, Gulf and Western.
Well, and for what it's worth, for all of the writing about Henry Kissinger that's sort of been exhaustively done, there's not as much, you know, written about his private consulting work. And even so, what's fascinating about the article too is that, you know, these articles, as sort of boring and as pared down as they became, actually did have an effect on Hirsch's target and on Gulf and Western. So even that said, it still had some impact. And I guess
some impact eventually. Yeah. It just wasn't the dramatic impact that people expected. I mean, you know, again, the big series he did before that, the CIA domestic spying program, had the greatest effect, I think, of, I mean, besides the Watergate stories, the greatest effect of pretty much any, you know, muckraking of our time, which was the Church Committee hearings and the Pike Committee hearings and the Rockefeller Commission. I mean, it was that, you know, rippled for years afterwards. And I think Hirsch's bad experience and the New York Times' bad experience going after corporate power and going after Gulf and Western in such a deep, profound way. You know, I mean, he wasn't just going after one thing they did. He really went after, it's kind of fascinating, he went after the companies, both their sort of the wrongdoings, but also kind of structurally, you really got, he peeled the whole thing open. And, you know, corporations want to live in secrecy. You know, as do spy agencies. I mean, that's, I think, another thing that attracted him to this. And he really kind of peeled it open. You got to look at a conglomerate on a lot of different levels in a way that, hadn't been done before and really hasn't been done since. I mean, you know, one of the things I think I'm learning writing about corporate power here in the technology sector and haven't looked, you know, and haven't written a bit about certainly like the Koch brothers and finance is how little we actually understand about the architecture of corporate power today. I mean, I think it's definitely a lot different from the conglomerate architecture that Hirsch wrote about. I mean, that was a new thing in the 60s and 70s. The conglomerates were then destroyed. It's a whole nother story, but they kind of went by the wayside and new structures kind of came up in the years since then. And we don't understand anything. We do not even, no one could tell you the structure of Google or Facebook. I mean, the full structure, eBay, you know, Coke Industries for that matter. Like, no one can tell you the structure of it. There are no, you know, NGOs that are dedicated to transparency of corporate architecture and corporate power. You know, the only place that people seem to be interested at all in corporate power is where it intersects with government power, which really just reinforces, you know, the whole focus on government power.
Right. And you see, that's so important because I think that that's been, you know, as we sort of move to closing this up, that's been something that you have really focused on a lot. And it's very important. And obviously exposing NSA surveillance, exposing all of this, you know, all of these covert programs that have happened under basically the war on terrorism framework through Bush and Obama is incredibly important. But even as we look at, like, you know, the supposed reform bills in Congress to rein in aspects of the Patriot Act, well, first of all, obviously they're incredibly limited and tepid reforms. But a lot of it is just sort of turning into, like, well, you know, government doesn't store metadata. Now the phone companies just will. And basically, yeah, first of all, yeah, government will have access to it whenever they want, regardless. And then, you know, this whole other question, which is that these companies whose whole sort of business model is built off of just incredibly sophisticated data mining, essentially, no one's talking about a sort of 21st century framework for consumer protections and for transparency and for how, you know, the sort of digital equivalents of putting seatbelts in cars. That conversation has been off the table because there isn't this scrutiny on corporate power, like you've pointed out. And then we have these anecdotes like, you know, Uber, some people have taken shots at them, pretty minimal shots. And there you already have a CEO at a dinner saying, like, hey, maybe I should, you know, I should send some private detectives after people who say negative stuff about us.
That was my editor, actually, Sam Lacey. Yeah, it was Emil Michael, the executive there, saying he was going to put a lot of money, $1 million, into following and smearing her family, actually.
Right.
She's got two children. You know, no fallout from that. I mean, look, the Snowden, you know, if you ask the Snowden revelations, the most significant ones and the ones I wish so badly that were followed up on, and I think a lot of other journalists do. Well, the Verizon one, you know, was big and great, and it confirmed, I think, the USA Today exposés in 2006. The Prism ones, the ones about Silicon Valley big tech companies, you know, working together with him. That to me was, that was the big one. And that one, we haven't really heard anything about NSA. We've heard very little about NSA and tech since then from the documents. And we've heard nothing about contractors. And, you know, we know from Tim Sharrock that 70% of the NSA is already privatized. 70% of the budget outlays go to contractors for the NSA. So it's more of a private organization than a public one. And, you know, part of that obviously is so that people can make money. And part of that is also when you have this murky public-private thing, accountability and legal accountability become themselves that much more murky. It's disappointing that so much of the story has since, you know, just almost exclusively focused on big, you know, big bad government. The government obviously in this case is bad, but it's not, you're not really getting the story. It'd be at least as bad if they only went after the companies and said nothing bad whatsoever about the NSA, you know, and only went after sort of like the companies that were doing something. I don't know why that's the case. It's hard for me to believe that out of the tens of thousands of documents, there's not more about contractors in there. But, you know, we just don't know. I mean, I don't know why we don't know more about that. It's just a big part of the story that seems to be missing, and hopefully it'll still come out. And, and it's a big part of the story in general that we're missing, I think, as, you know, that journalists aren't writing enough about. And again, because it makes our life a lot harder, the corporate private side of all this stuff. It's just a lot harder to do it. You have a lot more legal and sort of career roadblocks when you write about corporate power and when you challenge corporate power than you do if you write about government. I mean, you know, as a journalist, it's easier culturally for people to understand these days, the villain and the good guy. But more importantly, it's just easier to get it past your editor. They're not going to worry about getting sued out of existence if they write about government malfeasance compared to corporate malfeasance.
Absolutely. And just, you know, as a final thought, because a lot of this still also definitely goes back, and we've talked about how this sort of, you know, the Scientology of politics, which is how I talk about libertarianism, has kind of like, you know, defined so much of our era. And, you know, this is the problem. I mean, practically speaking, and just even like civically, I think building coalitions and where you can work with people on intelligence reform and on prison reform is great. And I'm willing to work with libertarians on those issues and have conversations. But there is such a fundamental problem, because that coalition and that conversation is only going to deal with the governmental aspect of this. And as you point out, with the role of contractors, even practically speaking, it's not really going to rein in an out of control intelligence system. And then more broadly, it's going to do nothing to sort of lay the rules of the road for how we manage basically, you know, tech capitalism and 21st century capitalism. And that's the name of the game right now, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, yeah, and I think culturally we kind of we just gave up on politics in some way by in the late 70s or early 80s. And so, you know, I mean, liberals before then, certainly like liberals from the progressive era to the New Deal era, were a lot more attuned to, you know, corporate power and how coercive and destructive it could be. And I think because they were a lot more aligned with labor.
Right.
And so you understand these things a lot more. And, you know, you just think about it intuitively. I mean, the fear of what the NSA could do is, I mean, it's potentially, you know, Orwellian, absolutely Orwellian, what they could potentially do with all this information that they're getting. But in reality, the overwhelming majority of us are much more impacted by private technology, private sector surveillance, let's just say, surveillance and you know, the use of private information about our credit histories, which may or may not be true, or our reputations, our online reputations, which may or may not be true. And we can't FOIA to get access to this and have it change. And this may affect our ability to, you know, buy a car or to get a job or to get health insurance. You know, all these things actually affect our mundane lives. But it's less sexy than the possibility of an Orwellian, Big Brother state like creating the sort of movie set, you know, horror film atmosphere.
Right.
And so, you know, the dramatics are much bigger in the government. And then just, it's just, it's a lot harder to write about what the corporations are doing. It's harder to get it past your editors, and it's harder to write about, and it's harder to get information.
Well, Mark Ames, I really appreciate you doing it, and it's always fun talking with you, and always, it's great. I appreciate your time as always, man, and I'll talk to you soon.
Cool. Thanks for having me
Thanks
on.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. I guess somewhere the choice is made for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my